Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This podcast is brought to you by Uma. If you're a small business owner, now more than ever, you understand the importance of being able to adapt so you can always be there for your customers. Uma Office is a cloud-based business phone service that gives small business owners the flexibility needed to run a business efficiently from anywhere. With features like mobile and desktop apps, a virtual receptionist, and call recording, you can do more for less. Uma Office starts at $19.95 per user per month with no contracts. To learn more, go to uma.com or call 833-TRY-OOMA.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Sunday, the 5th of July. Our main stories: President Trump tells Americans they'll soon overcome the coronavirus, despite a soaring infection rate that's led to muted Independence Day celebrations. In the biggest easing of the lockdown in England so far, pubs are allowed to reopen, but many stay shut. And a key witness in a corruption case against the former president of Argentina has been found dead. Also in the podcast...
You wonder why one man's born white and another isn't. It doesn't seem to matter so much how we were born.
It doesn't matter.
It does, you know.
One of the first black actors to find screen success in Britain, Earl Cameron, has died. July the 4th is normally a lavish celebration in America, with parades, fireworks and much flag waving. But this Independence Day, there wasn't much to cheer as the coronavirus continues to spread across parts of the country. Texas and Florida both reported record numbers of infections on Saturday. In Florida's case, it was worse than any country in Europe at the height of the outbreak there. However, in his Independence Day message, President Trump said the U.S. was on its way to a tremendous victory over COVID-19.
4 months ago, we had the best unemployment numbers. We had the best stock market numbers. We were doing better than any country had ever done in history. And then we got hit with this terrible plague from China. And now we're getting close to fighting our way out of it. Our country is coming back. Our jobs numbers are spectacular. A lot of things are happening that people don't quite see yet, but you'll see over the next couple of months. But I just want to wish everybody a really happy 4th of July.
Earlier, in a retort to protesters who had been pulling down statues, President Trump signed an executive order creating a new monument to commemorate historical figures in America. I heard more about that from our correspondent in Los Angeles, David Willis. But first, I asked him about how people were marking the July 4th holiday.
Well, we're seeing a patchwork quilt of restrictions imposed by local leaders, Oliver, who are now desperately trying to keep pace with the coronavirus outbreak, as a result of which beaches are closed in some places, Independence Day parades have been cancelled, and an estimated 80% of this country's community fireworks displays have been postponed amid fears that crowds could help spread the virus. And in one of the hardest hit cities in the country, Houston, Texas, the local fire chief is pleading with people not to set off fireworks of their own there, because more than 300 of his firefighters are currently quarantined after being exposed to COVID-19. In Washington, D.C., the mayor, of course, cancelled the traditional 4th of July parade, but that is not stopping President Trump from hosting an event at the White House that includes fireworks and that's expected to bring people flocking to the National Mall. And in New York, the traditional Macy's fireworks display, a central feature of the 4th of July, normally lasts for about an hour. It's being replaced with a series of 5-minute displays in different boroughs so that people get a chance to watch the fireworks without being attempted to gather in one place.
You mentioned President Trump. He issued that executive order creating a national garden of American heroes. Who might he put in it?
Well, it's a controversial move, and the president has signed an executive order which gives a new task force 60 days in which to find a location and present plans for the garden. State authorities and civic organisations will be invited to donate statues for it. But as well as the founding fathers, the president's list of historically significant Americans includes such people as the frontiersman Davy Crockett, the evangelical Christian preacher Billy Graham, and Christopher Columbus and Junipero Serra, a Spanish Catholic missionary, both of whom are far from heroes as far as Native Americans are concerned, because their discoveries led to the enslavement and exploitation of indigenous people here. So this won't be the last we hear about this somewhat controversial plan.
David Willis in Los Angeles. England has been celebrating its own version of Independence Day, as some of the newspapers here put it, with pubs, restaurants and hairdressers opening up for the first time in more than 100 days. The relaxation comes despite a rise in the growth rate of COVID-19, particularly in London and the South West. But many have been waiting for this moment for a long time, including Tim Holloway.
We own a 15-bedroom hotel in the New Forest, and we have a restaurant that normally has 40 covers. Reopening, we've had to change quite drastically what we are able to offer. So functions seem, at least at the moment, to be out the window. And we've had to reduce the capacity in the restaurant by almost half as well. With the reopening, I think some more clarity around the date quicker would have helped in terms of going to the market, getting bookings, letting people know so we can start to build our businesses back up. I think, you know, when I was shutting up the business and, you know, covering windows and putting signs saying, you know, no cash here, et cetera, et cetera, it was pretty demoralizing. But now the grass is cut and the new menus are printed, the staff are back, they've all got tans and long hair. And they look a bit scruffy, but, you know, they're all happy to be back. And, yeah, I can't wait.
Hotelier Tim Holloway. However, many businesses chose not to reopen their doors on Saturday, with industry insiders saying landlords were waiting to see whether social distancing rules were obeyed. Our business editor, Simon Jack, has been to a pub in southwest England.
A big moment for the national mood, hospitality business owners and the government. In Torquay, the Rock Garden opened at 11 o'clock and there was a slow trickle of customers at first, but by midday there were around 20 people, including a table of six, celebrating a 30th birthday party.
It's just the atmosphere, just the atmosphere, you miss.
Socialising makes you feel a lot better.
For the mental health and that, I think it's good. A lot of people stay in, don't they, weekends, and now they can go out and socialise with friends and that, because some people, that's all they do, isn't it? So hopefully it'll be better for everyone else now.
The fear of an unmanageable crush failed to materialise. The vast majority of customers were obeying the rules, but some groups were clearly closer than 1 metre apart. The other fear was that not enough people would turn up to make economic sense to be open. The bar owner, Dave Walsh, said though it was quieter than he expected, it was important to reopen, not just for him, but for businesses in the area, which rely on tourism and hospitality to survive.
A lot of the businesses here are intrinsically linked. We buy from local suppliers, fruit, veg, beer suppliers over just over across from Poynton. So we are all linked together, so we all need to keep going.
While an important staging post on the road to normality, the crisis facing the industry is far from over. Hospitality trade groups estimate that 3/4 of businesses will lose money this year and 500,000 jobs are still at risk. The government will be nervously watching to see if the economic benefits outweigh the inevitably higher health risks.
Simon Jack in southwest England. The UK has been behind other parts of Europe, both in imposing its lockdown and in easing restrictions. Some countries which have relaxed controls in the past few weeks are now seeing new infections. The latest is Spain, where parts of Catalonia are locked down again, affecting some 200,000 people. It follows a spike in cases around Segria, an agricultural area west of Barcelona. We heard more from local journalist Sara Canals.
This is significant. It is the first imposed lockdown since Spain lifted its restrictions about 2 weeks ago. And basically, starting today, people are not obliged to stay home, but meetings of more than 10 people are banned. Authorities are asking people to slow down their activity. Residents in that region won't be able to leave the confined area except for work or for a reason of force majeure. Nursing homes won't be able to allow visits, and people who are currently in that area but who do not live there are allowed to go back home. Now, this lockdown will be in place for 15 days, but we still don't know how long this is going to last. Authorities will make this decision based on how the situation evolves. According to the Catalan president, this was a very difficult decision to make today. Spain has been gradually reopening its economy and social life, people going back to restaurants, to bars, going back to work as well. They are welcoming tourists after a severe lockdown. But the president also considers that this was the right thing to do in order to avoid the spread of the virus.
Sara Canals in Barcelona. While governments struggle to contain the virus and scientists race to develop a vaccine, there are some voices saying, "We told you so." One of them is the science journalist Deborah McKenzie. She specialises in infectious diseases and has just written a book about why the global pandemic should never have happened. She spoke to my colleague Lise Doucette.
We knew it was coming. There's in particular been a couple of groups of virologists who have been looking into these viruses in bats, because a lab in China that was trying to find the source of the SARS virus. And these scientists were trying to find where that virus came from and what it was like. And they found all sorts of related viruses in bats. And some of them, as they tested them, they discovered were already perfectly capable of infecting humans. And they put out paper after paper after paper, all of which said, look, these viruses pose pandemic threat. But did anybody start up some like vaccine or drug research based on these viruses? No, because we don't have any mechanisms for doing that.
Well, let's look at some of the areas you draw attention to, starting first with governments, who obviously are responsible for their citizens. Why didn't governments, could we say right across the world, didn't listen to these warnings?
I think basically the problem is these are what the risk analysts call low probability, high consequence events. Having a pandemic is not a low probability. We know this is going to happen. And, you know, it's very hard to prepare for something just by taking a scientist's word for it. Countries aren't good at doing that. There's a lot of things they need to spend money on. Of course, you know, they spend on weapons systems, taking generals' words for it. And sometimes those threats are less obvious than the disease threat.
But you also find fault with the scientists as well as a group?
Well, scientists tend to sound the alarm a lot. But they're not really in the business of getting together and making recommendations to policymakers. I think that's possibly where they need to go next.
So what then is the next virus which is looming on the horizon that everyone should be preparing for before it hits?
Well, the WHO has a short list of about a dozen of them, and it makes very scary reading. But I was actually at a scientific meeting a couple of years ago. I was asking everybody, you know, okay, look, of all the viruses we're hearing about here, what scares you the most? And almost all of them said Nipah. So this is a virus from fruit bats, and it's been getting into people in Southeast Asia, and now it's spreading in India. It's just jumped from northeastern India.
So it's already on its way.
That's why they're scared. It's not just that they're moving around. This particular virus has got a huge fatality rate, at least half the people. In some cases, in when there have been outbreaks in Bangladesh, there have been like 75% of the people who caught it died. No, what's really scary is that usually, you know, when it's an animal virus, it can get into you, it can make you sick, it can kill you, but it can't find the exits and get into another human. Nipah seems to be learning. There have been a couple of cases where people caught it from other people, and it's spreading in respiratory droplets, with which we are now all familiar. So that's scary.
So do you think this new coronavirus has been a wake-up call?
Well, I hope so. I mean, it was discouragingly easy for me to write this book. I shouldn't say easy, because writing a book in 8 weeks, which is what this took, is really hard. But, you know, I already had done the research. People know this stuff. What worries me is that, generally speaking, once the immediate three alarm fire is over, people go, all right, now we can go back to business as usual. Things will return to normal and not spend money on the next pandemic.
My colleague Lise Doucette talking to the science journalist Deborah McKenzie. One of the first black actors to find success in Britain on film and TV has died at the age of 102. Earl Cameron was born in Bermuda and arrived in Britain just as World War II started. His acting career began shortly afterwards. Our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd looks back at his career.
Earl Cameron grew up in Hamilton, Bermuda. He joined the British Merchant Navy and in October 1939 arrived in London. Untrained, he talked his way into acting roles on stage. He had the looks and a natural presence. In 1951, he was cast by Ealing Studios in Pool of London. Earl Cameron played a part he knew well, a young merchant seaman arriving in London. It was a crime story with a social conscience about race.
You wonder why one man's born white and another isn't. And how about God himself? What colour's he? It doesn't seem to matter so much how we were born.
It doesn't matter.
It does, you know.
Pre-war, the American Paul Robeson had been the first black actor to be a major star in British film. After the war, Earl Cameron was one of a tiny number of black faces on screen.
In the 50s, when I started making films and so on, I was one of the few black actors out there. I always felt that it's important that I keep my reputation intact, if you like. I mean, I could be in London the whole day, and if I saw half a dozen black faces, I might have been lucky. And many others like myself, but we were sort of ambassadors, representative of our race in England.
Later, roles and films such as Simba and Safari were variable. Earl Cameron also played in TV drama, such as, in 1956, A Man from the Sun for the BBC.
Your people, Mr. Brent, must learn to adapt themselves. They drop down from the trees and expect us to fit them into the life of a modern city.
My people, Mr. Chairman, are not straight out of the jungle. They come to England with glorious dreams of the mother country. Very often they get disillusioned.
He never quite became a leading man. Perhaps the country Earl Cameron had adopted wasn't ready for such a thing. For a time, he moved to the Solomon Islands, but when Earl Cameron's first wife died, he returned to the UK and he acted again. Well into his 90s.
Vincent Dowd on Earl Cameron, who's died at the age of 102. This is the Global News Podcast, still to come.
I always eat a banana before I go on stage. After I eat the banana, I just feel a bit calmer.
We hear from a 12-year-old classical music superstar. When Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner was president of Argentina, Fabián Gutiérrez served as her private secretary until 2010. 2 days ago, he disappeared. His body has now been found in the town of El Calafate in the southern province of Santa Cruz. Mr. Gutiérrez was a witness in an ongoing corruption case against Mrs. Fernandez. From Buenos Aires, the journalist Natalio Casoy told me more.
As you well pointed out, he wasn't being found by his mother, who got really worried, went to the police on Thursday and asked them to locate her son. And on Saturday, finally, they found the body of this man, Fabián Gutiérrez, who's a 46-year-old businessman, was a 46-year-old businessman. And according to the information provided by Judge Carlos Navarrete, who's a local judge in El Calafate, he was found in the backyard of a house. He was buried and wrapped in a blanket and with signs of violence in his body. Four young men between 19 and 23 years old are in custody. And according to the information provided by people linked to the investigation, at least one of them gave the information that finally allowed the authorities to find the body.
And do they know that this was linked to the corruption allegations against the former president, who's now the vice president?
So far, speaking to local media, the judge said there were no links, and it's more he speculates at this point that he thinks linked to some form of extortion or some attempt by this group of young men to get money from Gutiérrez. But I believe that it will take some time to get a clear picture of what's happened there. These are just the first bits of information we're getting from that place.
And tell us more about the allegations against Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner.
Well, she had and has still some open cases against her. This one in particular is one that got kick-started in 2018 when a journalist received the cache of notebooks from a source. And these notebooks belonged to a former driver of a former government official during Cristina Fernandez's time in government, and this driver had written down information about alleged bribes linked to public works in which Cristina Fernandez is being accused. She denies any allegations, though.
Natalio Cossoy in Buenos Aires. Over the past few weeks, Iran has been hit by a series of fires and explosions, some at sensitive sites. In the latest incident on Saturday, a huge blaze damaged a power plant near the city of Ahvaz. It came just days after an explosion at the Natanz nuclear facility, the centrepiece of Iran's uranium enrichment programme. Before that, Iranian media reported that 19 people had been killed in a gas explosion in northern Tehran. So are all these incidents connected? I spoke to Siavash Ardalan from the BBC Persian service.
Well, on face value, it definitely is part of a pattern of fires breaking out in Iran's urban and industrial centers across the country. In fact, there have been dozens of fires breaking out across Iranian cities over the past month, not to mention hundreds of bushfires that have ravaged Iran's forests and agricultural land.
And who might be behind it?
Well, the Israelis, the U.S., the Saudis are the likely suspects. But first and foremost, they're talking about the possibility of Israeli involvement.
OK, and these are acts of sabotage against, what, Iranian infrastructure?
Well, it's the first time that the Iranian authorities are suggesting that, just about the incident in the Natanz nuclear facility, where initially they said it was a gas leak, and then they came out and said, well, we're not so sure about that. And then finally they said, well, we know what caused it, but we will not announce it until the right time comes up. And then after that, you had the Iranian state news agency saying that if it was an act of sabotage, then that would just completely change your calculus. So it could be very well be put down to domestic incompetence, U.S. sanctions that have dilapidated Iran's infrastructure, or it could be an act of sabotage, or it could be all the above. We just don't know.
And I guess if it is sabotage, it could be more than one group, could it?
Well, a domestic group, an opposition group, initially a few hours before the attack took place, sent an email to BBC Persian, and they claimed responsibility, but nobody's really believing that. They're putting it down to the possibility that, first and foremost, the Israelis may have done this. And if you look at how the Israeli media are covering this, they themselves are quoting their own security pundits and sources, which happen to be divided on the issue of whether Israel had a hand or not. But they're saying that if Israel was involved, then this must have been in retaliation to an attack that took place in the month of April, a cyber attack against Israel's water facilities attributed then to the Iranians, in which the hackers were trying to inject chemical material into the water system of Israel. It's just an ominous sign that if it is act of sabotage, then this just shows this country, both countries, Iran and Israel, have entered into this scenario where they are launching deniable cyber proxy attacks against each other's infrastructure, which can have devastating consequences for both countries' civilians.
Siavash Ardalan of the BBC Persian service. Ghislaine Maxwell, former girlfriend of the convicted financier Jeffrey Epstein, is expected to appear in court in New York next week. She faces charges of facilitating Epstein's sexual exploitation of girls and young women, as well as perjury. She's previously denied any wrongdoing. One of Ms. Maxwell's friends, Laura Goldman, has been speaking to the BBC, as Daniela Ralph reports.
Laura Goldman said she'd known Ghislaine Maxwell since she moved to New York in the 1990s and said she'd last spoken to her a couple of weeks ago. She described her friend as always being a little afraid of Jeffrey Epstein and believes she would now try to negotiate a plea deal with prosecutors. Asked whether Ms. Maxwell would talk about the Duke of York as part of the Epstein investigation, Laura Goldman said she didn't believe that would happen.
She's always told me that she would never, ever say anything about him. You know, I think she felt that he was her friend and she was never, ever going to say anything about him. She really felt that in the 90s, when her father died, that Prince Andrew was there for her in many ways.
During his interview with BBC Newsnight in November, Prince Andrew was asked about Ghislaine Maxwell. He said if there were any questions that Ghislaine had to answer, then that was her problem. Prince Andrew has repeatedly denied any knowledge of Epstein's actions, and his lawyers insist that he's offered to cooperate with the Department of Justice in the US a number of times.
Daniela Ralph reporting. Now, here's a name you could well hear a lot more of in future, Christian Lee. At the age of 10, he made history by becoming the youngest ever winner of the prestigious Menuhin Violin Competition. Now, at 12 years old, he's become a classical music superstar. He's been talking to our arts correspondent Rebecca Jones from his home in Melbourne.
I feel most happy and confident when I'm playing the violin. I can express my feelings a lot, and the singing sound of the violin is very lyrical.
Born in Australia, Christian Lee first picked up the violin at the age of 5. It wasn't inevitable. His Chinese parents aren't musical. But within months, Christian Lee was chosen to play the violin in a TV advert in China for powdered milk. And by the age of 10, he'd made history, becoming the youngest winner of the Menuhin competition, performing Summer from Vivaldi's Four Seasons.
I particularly liked the stormy ending. You can really feel the lightning, thunder and wind. And I think the music is really effective.
How nervous were you?
I just didn't give myself too much pressure. I get a little bit nervous just before I get on the stage, but after I start playing, I'm fine.
And now, at the age of 12, Christian Lee has become the youngest artist signed by the Decca Classics label. For his first single, he recorded the fiendishly difficult Dance of the Goblins.
When I first heard Dance of the Goblins a couple of years ago, I was really captivated. It was Maxim Vengerov playing, and I think I watched the whole piece without even actually blinking.
If you had to give yourself marks out of 10 for how you played that piece, how many marks would you give yourself?
Probably 9. I'm satisfied with it, but there's always room for improvement.
And that's why this self-possessed youngster practices for 4 hours every day after school, and more at weekends.
I just get used to it, and I enjoy it, and I feel a bit relieved after I practice, I think.
Doesn't sound to me like you have a lot of spare time, do you?
Well, I do actually have some spare time. I read some books as well. I like The Hobbit and Harry Potter. Really fantasy, all sorts of, like, magical things.
Christian Lee has performed at festivals and venues all over the world, including the Sydney Opera House and Carnegie Hall in New York. But his burgeoning career as a concert violinist has been interrupted by the coronavirus pandemic.
All of my overseas trips and concert performances were now actually cancelled, which is, you know, a little sad, of course. But actually, on the bright side, I can practice more technical things than before, and I can build up my repertoire to have more pieces to play. But of course, I miss having an audience.
Young violinist Christian Lee talking to Rebecca Jones. And that is all from us for now. There'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.